My name is Will Taft. I'm the chair of the board of Freedom House, and I'm delighted to be here together with our co-sponsors of the study Undermining Democracy, which I hope you all have seen a copy of, which we are releasing today. It's about 21st century authoritarians, or at least five different states of that sort. And Freedom House is delighted to be able to join with Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, and with Radio Free Asia in undertaking this study and having this meeting this morning. I will say for Freedom House, and I will be brief here, that we, of course, are well known for publishing each year our study of freedom in the world. It's called Freedom in the World, and it reviews the status of freedom all around in the 190-plus countries, and each year we grade them and see how they are doing. We have been concerned over the last several years, for 3 years, actually, of at least on our grading scale, there has been a negative trend in the course of freedom after some years of progress in this area, and about a decade or so. But the last 3 years have been somewhat negative. Of even more concern is that of the aspects of freedom that we track, freedom of expression and freedom of association we consider to be of the greatest importance, and also they tend to be, we have seen historically, and we've been doing this for some 40 years or so, they tend to be leading indicators of where the overall status of freedom in a country is headed, so that if freedom of expression is sort of the first thing to feel constraint, where all freedom is on the way out. So, having seen this trend over 3 years in our studies, and particularly having to do with freedom of expression and freedom of association, the negative trend there, we were pleased to undertake with Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, and Radio Free Asia the study of five countries to see what was happening here. Where was this pushback of authoritarianism? By authoritarianism, I should say, the pushback on freedom coming from, and what were the methods that were being used in these efforts. And we identified five countries that we were going to look at, and you will see what they are. China, Russia, Iran, Venezuela, and Pakistan as countries where we would study the different methods and practices of the leaders of those countries, both as to what they were doing inside their states and as to how they were perhaps even exporting some of their policies, and in a relatively more shameless way, let me say, than originally or than earlier, promoting the views, the benefits, let's say, as they saw them, of authoritarianism and progress in various areas other than freedom of expression and freedom of association and general exercise of political rights and civil liberties. So we have looked at that, and the result is the study that you see, and I commend it to you. We're going to have a great discussion here this morning from some very distinguished panelists, and we're hoping also for participation by some of the members of Congress, and we're grateful to the senators who have made available this room for us. And I would like to start by saying at this point that I want to turn over the podium here to Libby Liu, who is the head of Radio Free Asia, and she will say a few words. Libby.
Thank you. Welcome, everyone, and thank you for coming this morning. This morning, for fun, I pulled the home pages of Xinhua News in Mandarin and in English for June 4th. The headlines are about the central government pumping money, public spending into the public works, and all the faces involved in the General Motors bankruptcy. It is the 20th anniversary of the Tiananmen massacre. And in China, it is a total news blackout. It's not in the Chinese version. It's not in the English version. Why is it missing? Because if the authorities had their way, it never really happened. Everyone in this room knows June 4th was a pivotal event in the modern Chinese democracy movement. But in China, the discussion is absent. We'll talk today that this is just one part, one small part of China's growing strategy of suppression. Radio Free Asia's job is to break through that artificial silence. Radio Free Asia was born from the events of Tiananmen, born right here in the U.S. Congress. We'll continue to bring our listeners the news that's left out by state-controlled media. This is the information age, and in the information age, it's information itself that's most feared and most needed. This is the reason we are involved in this terrific project, and we thank you so much for being here. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Libby. The next task that I have, and we are hoping that some members of Congress, senators, will be coming to join us. And if they do, and when they do, we will certainly.
Congressman Hastings is here.
And my heavens! Well, what luck! We are hoping, and our hope is fulfilled. I understand Congressman Hastings is here, and. Very good. I'm delighted then, and we will immediately want to turn over the podium here to you, Congressman. But first, just very briefly, a word about Congressman Hastings. He is a very respected voice in international affairs and in human rights. He is, I think, most importantly, for our purposes, the co-chairman of the Commission on Security and Cooperation in Europe. And in fact, in 2007, he became the first African-American to chair that commission. He previously served as a member of the U.S. House Committee on International Relations and also previously held the position of President of the Parliamentary Assembly of the OSCE. He is also a member of the Tom Lantos Human Rights Commission. I'm delighted to be able to introduce Congressman Hastings this morning, and particularly with his association with the OSCE, which I know the former chair of Freedom House, Max Kampelman, did so much to bring about and strengthen in its early years. So if you are ready, Congressman, we will give you the floor.
Thank you very much, Mr.
Thank you.
After that warm introduction, I'm anxious to hear what I have to say.
Right.
Let me begin by thanking all of you, and especially Jennifer and Libby, Freedom House, and all our radio services, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, and Radio Free Asia. I genuinely commend all of you for convening this timely and important conference. We gather at a time of transition. Libby spoke very briefly. I heard some of her comments as I was coming in. As a relatively new administration takes the reins, and as we wait to see what content will be given to the democracy agenda of this new administration, and I'm sure today we wait with bated breath at remarks that are scheduled to be made in Cairo. We're all here, I assume, because we want that agenda to be both broad and deep. And I believe that President Obama's efforts to repair the good name of the United States will better position our country to lead in democracy promotion efforts. I was witness to the diminution of our reputation. For 14 years, really now 15, just coming from an economic conference in Dublin and going to Vilnius in July for the annual meeting of the OSCE. During that 14-year period, rising from rapporteur to vice chair of a committee, to the chair of a committee, then to vice president in the governing structure and president in the governing structure, the first American to hold that position, I would and still do talk with many colleagues. In Dublin Saturday night, I sat at a table with men and women that I've known for 14 years from countries ranging from Austria to Denmark to Germany to Ukraine. And we were talking about our long friendship and the fact that we have interfaced with each other. But those same men and women, during the run-up to many things that took place in the last 8 years, were very critical of our country. Now they hold expectations. I personally think those expectations are much too high for any individual or country to achieve. But at the same time, it brings an opportunity for us to do as much as we can, as fast as we can. If we want to lead, we must lead by example. And that means respecting the rule of law and human rights at home and abroad. And it also means for me, as I begin to tool legislation to deal with the critical subject of Guantanamo, it means for me that sometimes the law as we know it needs a new architecture. And that needs to be manifested by the bodies of law in order for us to achieve a new status and to calm this nation down about the status of those persons in Guantanamo. I regret that democracy promotion was to some degree tarnished by our government's actions and the rhetorical association of that goal with the invasion of Iraq. Of course, setting a good example will hardly be enough to get dictators in Iran or North Korea or Venezuela to follow suit. But it may help our credibility with those countries which might stand with us as allies in the effort to bring democracy to a greater part of the world. If anti-democracy regimes are going to work together, and it seems that they are, pro-democracy governments have to work that much harder, and we must work together. As we in this room seek to support our government in this endeavor, I'd make three observations. First, I think we have to be realistic about a paradox of democracy promotion. That is, for some government leaders, it is decidedly not in their personal interest to support democratic reform if it means their removal from power. A rhetoric which emphasizes regime change may not be very helpful in the near term. Second, free and fair elections remain a cornerstone of democracy, and we should not pull back from our commitment to them. At the end of this month, I will miss perhaps the biggest vote that's going to take place in this session, because it seems we always wait for last. I never have understood that dynamic here. The Friday before we go out of session, I've chosen to go to Albania. And the reason that I'm going to Albania is because they're holding an election. And I think an American presence there is critical. And for that reason, I will try to explain to my constituents that working in election monitoring is equivalent to voting on something that I probably voted on 16 times already. While free elections may be insufficient in and of themselves to establish a democracy, they are nevertheless an essential and necessary element of democracy. We've seen, of course, free elections produce some very unsavory results. I live in Florida. Think of the Hamas victory 3 years ago. The lesson there, I think, is that while the United States should continue to support free elections around the globe, we must also be better prepared for the emergence of illiberal regimes. While we support free elections, we must vigorously reinforce the other essential ingredients of democracy, from the rule of law to human rights. Finally, we must also seek to address the economic needs of societies around the globe. If I were to drop a footnote, it was easy for me, I served then as I do now on the Intelligence Committee, to see Hamas coming. I learned why Hamas would win an election in Algeria from a woman that was from the Western Sahara and had spent 8 years awaiting execution in France. She was a nurse, and she ultimately became a lawyer and is one of the more outspoken critics of those who would not adhere to democratic principles. It was an exciting evening listening to her and what she told me. When she was a girl, the king wouldn't permit girls to be educated. And she said one day two people from the Brotherhood in Egypt showed up in Western Sahara. And the first thing that they did was establish a little bitty school and let girls attend. And she said then more came, and they developed health clinics that had not been available to them. And then more came, and they brought food. Well, Hamas did the exact same thing right in the face of the world. And yet there were those in the intelligence community and other places arguing that they were not going to win the election. I told them differently. I proved to be correct because it was a simple proposition. It was the person that brought education, food, and health care. Education that I didn't like, our country didn't like, but it was education nevertheless. When democratic change occurs, too often nascent democratic governments are poorly positioned to provide meaningful economic improvements for the people who voted them into office. And as a consequence, democratic toeholds can be lost. In this hemisphere, it was legislation that I tooled as a freshman that caused Aristide in Haiti to be placed back in Haiti. Eyeball to eyeball with Bill Clinton, one-on-one on Air Force One, I said to him, "Mr. President, you have to give the people an opportunity to let hope attach." And I cited that if we were to build 25 prefab schools, 150 prefab houses, lay some sewers along the to City Soleil, and build two or three roads in the outer part of that country, hope would attach. And yet the donors met, and as donors do, they donor talked and didn't produce the money. And then over a period of time, Aristide was unable to deliver, as is the present government. And here we sit right here in our hemisphere with the poorest country in this area and feel as if, oh, well, that's all right. Footnote there, Darfur isn't all right either. What part of genocide do people not understand? And how is it then that we can ignore the fact that people are being killed every day as we sit in comfort and our voices are not raised other than to say it's genocide and then do nothing? Then I think people need to reread the treaty or at least say that they are hypocritical as they read it. As I said, these improvements for the people who voted for them come difficultly. In closing, I'd like to recall that this is the 20th anniversary of freely contested elections in Poland, the 20th anniversary of the fall of the Berlin Wall, and the 20th anniversary of the Velvet Revolution in Czechoslovakia, the Czech Republic, that brought the playwright and sometimes political prisoner Václav Havel to the presidency of his country. In a program sponsored by the Library of Congress under the aegis of the library, Mr. Billington, I had in the last 2 years two wonderful experiences. One was to have a 3-hour breakfast with two other members or with John Hope Franklin, and another to have a four-hour breakfast with two other congresspersons, with Vaclav Havel. I asked him, he was not well, but he was spirited, and I asked him how important Radio Free Europe was to him and what his vision is for it today. It was his lifeline. It was his ability to hear the views, he said, that continued to motivate him. And he said, there are people in areas of the world today, and you know it so well in the organizations that you people, you know that your voices need to be heard. My colleagues who want to cut Radio Free Europe and cut Radio Liberty evidently never had those experiences that Mr. Havel and others like him had and are having. When I'm in places and speak with opposition leaders, like in Belarus or other places, I learn from them that our voices speaking our truth to power do a difference make. We should take inspiration from those historic changes that I just cited too, as we seek to extend the freedoms achieved in those countries to others around the globe. Please know that at least in one member of the House of Representatives, you have an ally. I think that there should be more of what you do, and I think it should be properly remunerated by those of you that do it. Thank you so very much.
Thank you very much, Congressman Hastings, for those remarks, and they set us off, I think, on a very good course for our discussion of the Undermining Democracy study that we are releasing here this morning.